Let's talk a little bit tonight about the signs of the times. We've been observing the fact that God's given us a pretty detailed prophetic scenario in the Bible that describes the closing period of human history as we know it. It focuses very much in on that portion of history. The signs of the times are significant because this is a term which comes from Jesus Christ when he talked in the Mark version and said, you should learn to recognize the signs of the times. The last period of human history in our present program is called the Great Tribulation. And that period of history, 7 years long, is sort of the climax of history before God comes and says, okay, you've tried it your way. You've had enough time. I let you have plenty of time. If you were going to succeed, if you were going to come up with anything good doing it your way, you would have done it by now. That's it. Now we're going to do it my way. The moment that God intervenes into human history like that is going to actually be a moment at which the human race is on the very verge of self-annihilation. I think we'll find, as we study further into this, that the missiles will already be in the air. Too late to deny that the human race has finally and once and for all blown it in their quest to live apart from God. And it's at that time that God finally pulls out his whistle and blows it about as hard as he can. Now, the signs of the times are significant because these are things that show that will be in evidence as we lead up to that period called the Great Tribulation. The signs of the times could extend back a number of years. No one knows exactly how many before the actual tribulation itself begins. As we get into the signs of the times, you've probably noticed by now, we're thinning out the crowd here, hopefully because we're getting pounded with a storm tonight, and not because we're wearing down the endurance, the sheer mental power of the group here. We're into a subject that is complicated, and it is detailed. And yet, I think that it's the very fact that it is so intricate, so detailed, and complicated that makes it convincing and persuasive to me. Tonight we're going to be correlating several different passages together on the same subject, and because this is supposed to be like a 40-minute lecture, we're going to have to sail pretty high and thin. We're not going to be able to get down into the kind of depth into those passages, studying the context and so forth that I would like to. And frankly, that would be a very interesting study. I think one of the better surveys on this is The Things to Come by Dwight Pentecost, which we have on sale at the resource table. Also, the commentaries on Matthew by John Walvoord, and Walvoord also has a commentary on Daniel that's quite good, called Daniel, Key to Biblical Prophecy. We're going to be touching on Daniel tonight. The points I make here are made in much more detail in his excellent commentary. Anyway, we've been looking so far at some ecological signs, and we noticed that most of them are now at hand, or certainly, if not at hand, for instance, in the case of the Ashen Horse, the pestilence that's predicted, great plague sweeping the globe. No, maybe we don't actually see that yet in full force. We see some of it. Certainly the stage, though, is set. The stage is set for that. And the sign, I think, could break upon us with a lot of ferocity pretty soon. Then last week we got started on political signs, including this key sign, the regathering of Israel, a crucial beginning point, something so extraordinary that there's nothing even in history to compare it to. A one-of-a-kind event that was predicted, that was implausible, seemed completely fanciful and even ridiculous, particularly after these people had been scattered across the world for 1,000 years. And yet centuries and centuries after that went by and they were still scattered across the world. And yet the Bible said they will all be regathered into their own land. And lo and behold, we look out our window today and we see happening the very thing that Scripture predicted in detail. In 67, they finally retook the city of Jerusalem, and even as we sit today, the greatest surge of immigration into Israel yet in their history is going on right now. Last week, we studied quite a bit about one-worldism, an ideology which is gripping the hearts and minds of people the globe over, that we really need to come together in a one-world society, a one-world government. And one of the things that has surprised me in recent years in my reading, I always assumed that this would have to be, you know, world governments deciding to align themselves with one another and more or less forming this one world confederation or something of that sort, a UN type of deal. And now, as we read today, the theater where one worldism is growing the most is in the field of business and commerce and finance. And we're finding that the union that is actually being resisted by national governments is already occurring de facto in the world of business and finance. And we just have to wonder, when an economic reality says we're all in the same system and we're all basically functioning like one big nation state in the world, how long can individual governments sustain their legitimacy? Then we have on our list of political signs that there will be a great Eastern power. Another is the unification of Europe into a 10-nation confederacy. And finally, this one known as the Antichrist. And these are the ones that we want to talk about tonight. Let's start out with a general political scenario of the last days. We know that there's a basic power alignment that is in place at the time of the Great Tribulation. Now, there is a short period of time where the entire world coalesces into a single government, but that's very brief. In general, the power structure is viewed this way: the beginning point of biblical revelation, the nation of Israel. And that nation has to be back in place, according to the Bible, before this scenario can occur. Well, that sign's now at hand. To the north, the Bible declares, will be a great military power. They refer to them by their ancestral tribal names as Gog and Magog, and Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. These are tribes which are identified as Scythians in the Jewish literature. Tonight we don't have time to go into Ezekiel 39, which is a chapter that goes and to 38-39, quite a bit of detail about Gog and Magog. Their identifying characteristic: large, strong in military might, and lying to the uttermost north, the remote parts of the north of Israel. This could easily refer, readers would have naturally assumed a few years ago that this would be the Soviet Union. Now that the Soviet Union no longer exists, it could be some republics that used to be a part of the Soviet Union. In particular, of course, likely, we know that Gog and Magog, the other feature that we know about them is that they're hostile to the nation of Israel. And that would probably be true of many of the southern republics in the former Soviet Union, most of which have a Muslim majority, and Muslim states tend to resent the nation of Israel. To the south, Gog and Magog have a group of allies described as Ethiopia, Cush, and Put. These again are tribes that relate to Middle Eastern and African peoples. And so there is an African Arab confederacy that's allied with this northern Scythian. The Scythians were those who lived in the steppe of Russia, who lived beyond the Black Sea. And they are in an alliance, and they launch an attack against Israel. That's what begins the campaign we know as the Battle of Armageddon. To the east, the Bible describes a power they refer to as the kings of the east in Revelation chapter 16, verse 12. And this power, all we know about them is that they lie to the east from Israel, beyond the river Euphrates, and that they're very numerous, because it's their entrance into this war that provokes the comment that by now the number of combatants reached 200 million soldiers, according to chapter 9, verse 14 to 19. You have to correlate those passages and see that they're both referring to the same power and the same period of time. And this occurs right near the end of history. We'll touch on these passages in detail later. Then there is a power to the west of Israel in general, which is a 10-nation power centered in Europe, centered in what used to be the Roman Empire. And this last power is the one that comes under the leadership of the so-called the beast, or the Antichrist in the Bible. So we're being told that we should look for the rise of a cluster of nation states, 10 in number, who will form a power that will become the greatest power on earth. And it will be arising out of European culture. Let's look at some of these scriptures that refer to the beast and his 10-nation power, starting with Jesus' comments here in Matthew 24. It's easy to miss this, but Christ refers to the Antichrist when he says in verse 15, "So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through Daniel the prophet, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." So note carefully that he refers to something called the abomination that causes desolation. The abomination of desolation. It's a term that's used in Jewish theology. It comes from the Old Testament, from the prophet Daniel, which as he says. And so we're going to look at the passage from which this couple of the passages that give rise to this phrase. And Jesus says, watch for that. Watch for the abomination of desolation, because when you see that, it's time to run for the hills. He says, for at that time, when you see that, there will be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. And unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. And I give you these verses for your context, time-wise, to realize that the act referred to as the abomination of desolation is very close to this great battle, which he says has the capability to destroy all life on earth. The language clearly ties these closely together. Now let's go back to Daniel and find this mention of this so-called abomination of desolation in Daniel chapter 9. We studied this chapter before, and when we studied verse 24 and 25 about the coming of Messiah, it dated the coming of Christ from the issuing of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem, which was in 444 BC, to 62 weeks of years, which turned out to be 483 years converted over to Hebrew years, 476 years. It ended up at 33 AD and said that the Messiah would come. So this was a remarkable prediction. And that all happened over the period of 7 weeks and 62 weeks, a total of 69 of the 77s that are allocated to the Jewish people. Whatever happened to the 70th week? We never studied that part. And this is what comes up in tonight's study. Because in verse 26 he says, then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and will have nothing. Now, for the Messiah to be cut off is an idiom, to be cut off out of the land of the living. It means that the Messiah will be killed. And then, he says, the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now remember, when Daniel wrote this in the 500s BC, there was no temple. The temple was lying in ruins, having been torn down by King Nebuchadnezzar. And so God is telling him, the temple will be rebuilt. This is this decree, that to rebuild Jerusalem and so on. Then, after the temple exists for these, you know, several hundreds of years, well over 400 years, the Messiah will come. He gets put to death, and then the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary again. So it's going to Jerusalem destroyed once when Daniel was a young boy, and destroyed again at the end of this period, after the 62 weeks, he says. Now that happened. Remember, we started this discussion in Matthew 24 when Jesus was looking at the temple saying not one stone would be left on another. And he predicted, not long from now, this temple will be completely eradicated. And it was, by the Romans. That was predicted by Christ, but it was also predicted back here in the Old Testament, where Daniel said, it's going to be destroyed a second time. Notice who does the destroying. The people of the prince who is to come. The language is very precise here, and it's important to pay close attention to that. Not that the prince who is to come does it. That's not what it says. It says the people of the prince who is to come. There's another prince to be expected, a ruler, a great one. And it's his people who destroy this temple. Now we know who destroyed the temple the second time. We know that. The temple in Jerusalem today is still not there. It's destroyed. And the ones that destroyed it were the Roman Empire. And therefore, we can fairly conclude that the Romans are one and the same as the so-called the people of the prince. The Roman power, the Roman people, are the people of the prince who is to come. They're the ones that destroyed the temple. Its end will come with a flood, he says. Even to the end, there will be war and desolations are determined. So, fine. But then the question still remains, who is the prince? We have the people of the prince that did this act. But who is the prince himself? In answer to that, we read on, and the next thing we see is a reference to he will confirm a covenant with the many. He who? He, the prince who is to come, the nearest antecedent. He will confirm a covenant with the many for one unit of 7 years. So this is predicting that this prince who is to come, whoever he is going to make a covenant with the Jewish people. Some sort of a treaty or an agreement, a 7-year agreement. We read that, so the prince whose people were the Romans, is going to make the covenant with the Jewish people for 7 years. Then we read in the next section that in the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering in the middle of this 7-year period. He puts an end to sacrifice and offering. Now, the modern reader might miss some points here. It would be easy for us to think, well, this is unremarkable. But the Jewish reader would be aware, first of all, when we speak of sacrifice and offering, grain offering, there's really only one place where it's legal to do this. You cannot do this in your backyard. There is only one place that a Jew can legitimately give sacrifice to God, and that is in Jerusalem, in the temple. The odd part about this is that the temple was already torn down and destroyed, according to what we just read, right? Now it seems like we're either recovering that history, or that the temple has now been rebuilt. And that, in fact, is what he is predicting. After saying the sanctuary and the city were destroyed in verse 26, here the prince puts an end to sacrifice and offering, implying that the temple is rebuilt. Now Jesus, for instance, speaking in his day, 500 years after this was written, said, an abomination of desolation is coming into the sanctuary, into the holy place. Watch for that. And when he said this, he spoke of this still in the future, in his day. In verse 27, then, we read, as we keep pushing down through the verse, after in the middle of the seven, putting an end to sacrifice and grain offering, on a wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. This act, an abomination of desolation, was, in technical Jewish parlance, this was when you would go into the temple of God and desecrate that temple, committing blasphemy right in the presence of God, as it were. It's an abomination that causes desolation, something that God will not overlook. This act, which was committed at one other time in history, in about 165 BC, by a Grecian ruler, a Macedonian ruler, it says will be committed again by the prince who is to come. This future prince will commit the same act. And this act of the abomination of desolation is associated with the end times. Christ, as we saw, associated it directly with the end times and the end of life on earth, right? Here, it doesn't get into much detail. It just says, until the end that is decreed is poured out on him, which occurs only 3.5 years. Notice when it is he accomplishes this, in the middle of the seven. That means there would be 3.5 years before it, 3.5 years after it. And this 7-year period is the period we call the tribulation. In another passage of Daniel, he sees visions which identify who this prince who is to come is, and also, once again, identifies him with the Roman people and the Roman culture. This would be back in Daniel chapter 7. Reading from verse 2 on, and we're going to really have to just sort of skim this. I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Probably a symbol for all the peoples on the earth. This comes up again later. And four great beasts were coming up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion, and had the wings of an eagle. And he goes on and describes it further. Behold, another beast, a second one. It resembled a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and there were three ribs sticking out of its teeth. And then behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings like a bird. And this beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Later in this passage, it explains who these are. Okay, we haven't got to that part yet. The lion, it turns out, is none other than the Empire of Babylon, which Daniel was living under their rulership when he wrote this. The next one, the bear, is the empire that overtook Babylon. And he mentions it being raised up on one side, which probably refers to the fact that the Medes and the Persians joined and formed this empire together. First, the Medes were in ascendancy, and later the Persians were, and in history has come to know it as the Persian Empire. Then come a power called the leopard, which is identified by the fact that it has wings and it has four heads on it. And this would refer to Alexander. It says that the first king in this dynasty dies when he's quite young. And I'm reading from later in Daniel now. Because, you know, with Daniel, unlike some of the other spurious so-called prophetic works, we're not left to interpret it on our own. We get the text itself will tell us what the symbols mean. And these are indeed four kingdoms, four empires. There's three here, and there's a fourth one coming. He has four heads because the Grecian dynasty formed by Alexander the Great was divided into four parts, and through most of its history existed as a kingdoms of Macedonia, of Egypt, where the Ptolemies were, and of Syria. And that was the way they are known to history. And Achaia is the fourth one. Then Daniel looks and says, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. It had large iron teeth, and it devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, as we go on in his description, he spends more time on the fourth beast than all the others put together. And it's the fourth beast that interests Daniel. He describes it as extremely powerful, much more so than the others, which would be very true of the empire that this symbol represents, namely the Roman Empire. More powerful, more controlling, longer lasting, covering more area, in every way, grossly more powerful than any of the empires that have preceded it. He says, while I was contemplating these horns, these 10 horns on its head, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them. And 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and mouth uttering great boasts. I kept looking until thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days took his seat. The court sat and the books were opened. And you know what this last part is about. This is when God sets up the judgment day. And he goes on to talk about how I saw one like a son of man coming whose kingdom is eternal and without end. So the career of the fourth beast with its 10 horns and with the little horn ends with the coming of God to establish his rule on earth. Now he says, I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the little horn was speaking. And kept looking until the beast was slain and his body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. He says, I was troubled. I didn't know what I was reading. And so skipping down a little bit, he says, he asked the messenger that brought this to him. He says, what does this mean? What are these symbols? And so he starts to explain it. He says, these great beasts, which are 4 in number, are 4 kings who will arise on the earth. But the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. Now, that's the short version of what it's basically about. He says, well, I desire to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful with its teeth of iron, its claws of bronze, which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And the meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head and the other horn that came up and before which 3 of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts and which was larger in appearance than its associates. As I asked him about all those things. And so, thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from the other kingdoms. It will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom. Okay, so there is the kingdom itself. And then he says, out of that kingdom will come 10 other kings. And then after them arises another. That's the little horn. The little horn turns out to be the beast, the Antichrist. And the 10 horns turn out to be not the original Roman Empire, but a resurgence, a renewal, if you will, of what used to be the Roman Empire. Rome 2. We could call this Rome 1 and Rome 2. Which is what he says. He doesn't say that the 10 horns are part of the other kingdom, but that out of that kingdom they rise. And that is exactly what we will see in each passage about the beast and his 10 nation power, is that they arise out of the ashes of the Roman Empire. He will speak out against the Most High and will wear down the saints of the Highest One. He will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for time, times, and half a time. This is a Hebrew way of saying a year, 2 years, and half a year. And we know that that's what that means because we can correlate it and compare it to parallel statements where it says the same thing. It gives the same period of time as 42 months and also as 1260 days. In each case, it's 3.5 years. Well, we just read a passage that talked about how the prince who is to come puts an end to grain and sacrifice offering in the middle of his 7-year tenure with Israel, which would be 3.5 years. And here we see the 3.5 years again. This is the guy that Christ is referring to and saying, watch out when you see this guy, because he's the one that commits the abomination of desolation. We see that he's a persecutor of believers in God. This guy wants people to worship him, like the kings of old who were worshipped as deities. This will once again be a world ruler who insists upon being viewed as a deity. And he succeeds in selling this bill of goods to the world for a period of time, 42 months in length, 3.5 years. At that point, everything breaks up. And chaos bursts in, warfare breaks out, which ultimately leads to Armageddon itself. And so the messenger says, the court will sit for judgment and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Let's compare what Daniel says about the little horn and about the prince who is to come. And you notice, by the way, in Daniel, in both of those passages, there's what we call a prophetic gap, where he's describing a sequence in history that's more or less continuous, and then all of a sudden there's a jump in time and we begin to discuss something that is far future. And that gap in time embraces the church age, the age in which we now live, which is often skipped over in ancient prophetic literature, just as we saw Jesus do it when we studied last week, where he said Jerusalem would be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Then he takes up and starts to describe what will happen at that point. And so it's like from his day until the end of the period of the Gentiles, it's just like there's nothing to say about that. It's funny that the Hebrew scriptures are very Hebrew-centric. They focus on the history of Israel. And it's when Israel is front and center that history matters in biblical terms. But they skip the parts like the period of the Gentiles, the church age, when God is dealing in large measure with non-Jews. In the book of Revelation, the Apostle John had a vision. Listen to this one. He talks about the dragon, which he identifies for us in chapter 12, verse 10, 8 to 10. The dragon, which was the serpent and Satan, the devil of old. He says, this is the dragon is the devil. And he says, I saw the dragon stood on the shore of the sea. And I saw a beast coming out of the sea. So look how similar this is to Daniel, right? They both see beasts coming up out of the sea. This beast, he says, had 10 horns, like Daniel's beast. Also, he had 7 heads, which is a new twist. On the horns, he has 10 crowns. You know what a crown or a diadem? It's a crown. And you know who wears crowns? Our kings. So once again, just as in Daniel, where the 10 horns represent 10 kings, here too, they each have horn on. We don't have to wonder whether this is what it means. We'll read later a text that explains the whole thing. He says, the beast I saw resembled a leopard, but it had the feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. So he draws all of Daniel's beasts together into one, sort of a composite beast. But it's the same beast that Daniel had. And the dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. So this beast receives his power and authority from Satan himself. Now, one of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound. But the fatal wound had been healed. And the whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Then he says, men worshiped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. And they also worshiped the beast. And they asked, who's like the beast? Who can make war against him? The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies, just like the little horn in Daniel, isn't it? And to exercise his authority for 42 months, same unit of time. The beast of Revelation 13 is the little horn of Daniel 7. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place, and those who live in heaven. And he was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. And he was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. This is the one who finally puts it all together and establishes world rule. Every tribe, people, language, and nation. There's four different ways of saying it. Everyone comes under the rulership of this guy, this beast. In Revelation 17, the beast is discussed once again, verse 9 through 13. The angel says to John, I will tell you the meaning of the beast on whom she rides, the whore of Babylon's riding on beast, a scarlet beast with 10 horns, 7 heads, it's the same one. She says, and I'll explain to you the 7 heads and the 10 horns. The inhabitants of the earth will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. Okay, and this is similar to the language about one of his heads had a mortal wound, but it was healed. Right? Now, the heads. Okay, let's talk about this. This calls for a mind with wisdom, he says. The 7 heads are 7 hills on which the woman sits. There are also 7 kings. 5 have fallen. 1 is, the other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for a little while. Now, this is written in 90 AD. And so the time reference is from that period, looking backward and forward. The beast who once was and now is not is really an 8th king. And he belongs to the 7 kings, and he's going to destruction. Now here, I'll suggest to you, is what these 7 kingdoms are, the 7 heads of the beast. They are, in fact, the kingdoms or the empires that have persecuted Israel. You had first Egypt, which enslaved Israel, Assyria, which destroyed the 10 northern tribes, Babylonia, under who Daniel wrote, the Persians and the Greeks, who were the beasts that he foresaw. And these 5 empires, then, are all, at the time he writes this, now past. Right? These are all past. 5 have passed, he says. 1 is, that would be the Roman Empire, which currently had Israel under their subjection and was persecuting them. And 1, he says, is yet to come. That would be number 7, and it refers, interestingly, to Rome too. One of the heads, now these are the heads, right? 7 heads. One of the heads, he says, appeared to have a fatal injury, but it was healed. And I'll suggest to you that the head that was fatally injured was number 6, Rome. The Roman Empire was obliterated. But it was healed, it came back. And people were astonished to see this. This resurgence of Rome. That's the beast's empire. That's the 10-nation confederacy. Let's talk about this verse 11 in chapter 17 of Revelation. The beast who once was and now is not is an 8th king. He belongs to the 7, so he really comes out of that 7th group, Rome 2. That's where he rises. And that's similar. This is very similar to what Daniel says, right? First you had the fourth beast with his 10 horns, and then out of them, after they were already there, a little horn grew up and pushed out some of the others. And this picture is very similar. He's saying he comes up out of the 10-nation group, but he's like, it's so different that it's like a new 8th empire almost, because it's like a new program that he brings in. Verse 12 says, the 10 horns are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. So we haven't been imagining this sense that there is predicted a 10-nation, a 10-kingdom power that will be associated with the beast. This is it, right? This is what it's discussing right here. People say, well, the Antichrist will have a mortal head wound and then comes back to life. And they say, maybe, you know, I remember the Fundies used to say, well, maybe John F. Kennedy is the beast, and he got shot in the head, and then he's going to come back to life. The head is explained to us as one of the nations, right? Since it's one of the kingdoms. And the kingdom that was destroyed is Rome, and that is the one that will come back. It's talking about the destruction and the revival of the Roman Empire. Europe is really what this is. When you speak of the people and culture of the prince, the people of the prince who is to come, you're talking about Europe, because that is where Roman law, culture, and people really have wound up preserved. You know, in most of the Middle East, the people in the Middle East and even Northern Africa are different than the people who were there during Roman times. And those, in fact, have been incursions from the East. The Arab peoples in Arabia were not a part of the Roman Empire. But when we speak of Europe, these peoples in Europe were part of the Roman Empire. Because this is why you'll hear it said that the Bible predicts a European power of 10 nations that will rise up and become the dominant power on earth. Because we read for ourselves that the beast, who is in this 10-nation grouping, has jurisdiction over every tribe, nation, people, and tongue, right? And I know I'm not giving you a lot of context and background. We just have to move here because this is a very short study. I'm trying to let you read this with your own eyes and see why we think this. We don't have time to go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 tonight, but in verse 3 and 4, you can read there for yourself about, we'll read it later in our study, in our series. That's also about the beast. It also mentions the abomination of desolation and says he comes into the temple of God, declaring himself to be God. And Paul there warns that that's a key sign, and he says that hasn't happened yet, so you know very well we're not in the Great Tribulation, the last part of the seven-year period, because otherwise that would happen by now, and it hasn't. All prophetic scenarios really latch on to this abomination of desolation. And associated with it are these 10 nations. Now, this predicted power arising out of Europe, as we sit today, may already be forming before our eyes, because the strangest thing has been happening during the last half of this century. The European nations, which have been warlike and bitter rivals for so many centuries, really all the way back to ever since Roman times, have done nothing but fight one another. Even in our own century, these European nations who hate each other, have hated each other historically, have been the locus of the bloodiest, most terrifying wars in all of history. But now, ever since World War II, they're heading a new direction. And the nations of Europe are seeking union with one another, just exactly as the Bible predicted they would. Now, the U.S. could even belong to this confederation as well, conceivably, because it's not the geography of the Roman Empire that Daniel refers to, but rather the people of the prince. That is to say, the people who made the Roman Empire up, which is Europeans, and essentially we are Europeans too. So it's possible, and now they're not saying this is true, but it's possible that powers like the U.S. and other European colonies in the world could join this confederation and still be faithful to the description given in Scripture, that it's made up of the people that used to be the Roman Empire. It's a revival of that empire. With or without the U.S., though, putting that question aside, such a power, even if it was just based in Europe itself, would have immense power if they do succeed in their aspirations to unify. The first Treaty of Rome was signed in 1948, and in that, the European states vowed that they would try to work toward unity. And this has been reiterated at point after point along the way. In 1979, the first European election was held, and the European Parliament was elected, and it sits in Brussels, Belgium, today. In 1992, Europe reached the end of a long negotiating process, and actually it didn't actually happen for about 2 years after that, but in 92 they signed an agreement that dropped all trade barriers between the members of the European community. And today in Europe you can cross open borders just like between Ohio and Indiana. Drive right across the borders, and you can take goods across. There are no tariffs. They had competed with one another, costing one another huge sums in the paperwork they had to do. Every time you brought a truck full of grapes from one country to the other, you had to pay tariffs. You had a mountain of paperwork to do. There were border checks, and this just slowed down business terrifically. And as a result, Europe, fractionalized into pieces, could not compete effectively with the U.S. and Japan, who came to dominate the economic landscape in the world. And it was this realization by Europeans that two economic superpowers were coming to dominate the world that sort of greased the skids and made them much more eager to complete the act of forming a United States of Europe. It's been a rocky road, and this process has not been completed yet in 1996. But they're on the way. Listen to what some of the authorities say about the rising European economic community. The shock to Europeans of a future world dominated by two foreign economic superpowers sowed the seed of a new loyalty. And yet, with so much attention turned to Japan, the fact that a combined Europe would account for 20% of the world's exports against 15% for the United States and Japan's 9% has been overlooked by most people. The European community, when they join together, become the largest trading power in the world. Now, in view of the plan for unification, Europe's previously disjointed consumers will combine to form a 320 million person trading consumption machine that will fire up both offensively and defensively to achieve international consumption goals of a combined Europe, outnumbering the population of the United States or of Japan. In 1988, Schmidt-Medley polled Americans to find out which countries they thought invested most in American companies. 73% of those polled assumed that Japan accounted for the majority of investment. 10% cited oil-rich Arab countries. Only 3% knew that Europe had taken the lead. A lot of Americans are not really well aware of what's happening in Europe today. For example, here is investment in U.S. companies from 80 to 87 in billions of dollars, comparing Europe on the left to Japan on the right. Europe is far more powerful than Japan in terms of investment. Silver and Shogren point out that they lead the pack in developing international consortia. And we studied last week how important that's becoming in the operation of world business. And who stands at the head of the pack in that? Europe. This accounts for why the number of American workers employed in the U.S. operations owned by European companies, which accounts for 2 million American workers, or almost double the U.S. workers employed by the rest of the world combined. I wouldn't have thought that. I would have thought the Japanese employed the most Americans. But actually, Japan and all the rest of the world put together wouldn't even be half of what Europe employs. The unification of Europe will surpass the Japanese rise to economic dominance. Ironically, while the United States' gaze remains fixed on the skyline and ticker tapes of Tokyo, Europe has been steadily growing into an economic power that will challenge and ultimately stifle the current samurai siege on the world economics. Jack Welch, the CEO of General Electric, warns that the new Europe will make the experience with Japan seem like a cakewalk by comparison. Well, ask yourself this question. Would California succeed in taking on Japan all by itself? Even the whole U.S., you know, has a huge trade deficit with Japan. Japan's very competitive, very tough. If the whole U.S. has trouble matching up economically with Japan, you know, one state, even a big one, like California, would be hopelessly outmatched. That's analogous to what we're dealing with in Europe, where you have, right now, 12 member states, several of which are in the size range of California. And they now, though, form a nation substantially larger, or they will form a nation substantially larger than the United States. Well, recently we've read that when several countries resisted the formation of a single European currency, this was supposed to be done by 92, now it's been rescheduled for 99, then you go to Europe and there'll be one currency for all of Europe. In the recent debates, many of the business leaders have argued that they don't need a European currency because their economies are already thoroughly integrated. And this relates to the material we were studying last week. Integration and business acquisition across borders in Europe has been going on at furious rates. And these businesses are now all inter-owned within the European community to the point where currency hardly even matters anymore. I'm not even sure that's going to be a significant event if they ever do it. Well, we started with a historical or with a geopolitical scenario for the last days that had Israel at the center, and that we had discussed the week before. Gog and Magog, we didn't get time to study in depth, but the powers described are certainly there. In fact, now you even have the Islamic bomb exists. Several of these are nuclear powers, like the Ukraine, like Kazakhstan, and southern what used to be the Soviet Union. As far as the kings of the East, we have a power there. Did I mention that one other feature of the kings of the East is that they had the ability to kill a third of the human race? So that must be a nuclear power. They must be very numerous, and they must lie to the east of Israel. There's a power there that kind of looks like that in communist China. And then when we think of Gog's allies, an Arab and African confederacy hostile to Israel, hardly difficult to imagine that. In fact, the Arab League is made up of nations and fits that description perfectly. Finally, the Bible describes a 10-nation power in Europe. You know, today there are 12 nations in the European common market. Not long ago, it was 10. Before that, it was 14. So this number has gone up and down. Right now, it's at 12. Look for 10, because that's the number that we're given, and that's what the number will be when the dust settles. There'll be 10 nations in that confederacy. Denmark is seriously considering withdrawing right now. That would move us to 11. I don't know how that's going to work out, but it will work out, like all these things have. Well, maybe it's not there, but the makings of it are certainly there, so we'll give that a check and a question mark. And I think, frankly, that this is an amazing scenario all the way around, just absolutely amazing. You know, in conclusion then, the political scenario of the last days must have seemed fanciful, even ridiculous. Just 200 years ago, even 100 years ago, this would have been impossible to imagine. There would have been no Israel. There would have been no great power to the north of Israel. China was a backward agrarian society that posed no threat to anybody outside their borders. Europe was fighting with each other as vigorously as ever. They were deeply divided. There wasn't the slightest urge on anyone's part to get together or form any kind of union. Just really a very short time ago, look at it today, everything's changed. Of course, there was no Arab and African group that was hostile to Israel. There was no Israel. So this has all just happened very quickly. You know, people say, well, you know, the Bible bangers are always yapping about these prophetic things. And these are really just things that happen all the time anyway. Well, this whole scenario has never been present before. The closest to it would have been in the days when the Bible itself was written. But who would have believed that we would get back to that scenario again? So it's not fanciful anymore. Today we look out, this is very realistic, as a matter of fact. Incredibly, the pieces to this scenario are all really present today, either in fact or in principle. Everything is set for this scenario. And from that, we have to be just amazed. The Bible is truly one source of insight that goes way beyond anything that anyone could see. The wisest person in the world never could have predicted that this was coming. Certainly 2,000 years ago, they would have had no way to predict anything like this. And yet, we sit and we read it and we see it is predicted, it has happened. It's just really gotta have an impact. I mean, you gotta look at that and just think, wow, the Bible has a reliability factor because of this sort of thing that just can't be found elsewhere. So I would conclude then that since that same Bible tells you how you can come to know God personally, then the same authority, the same inspiration that gives us the ability to tell the future course of history is there telling us, you know, God speaking and telling us how you can get together with me. Jesus, who spoke these words, we started with Christ tonight, declared that his death opens the way to a direct relationship and a forgiveness with God. The whole point of Christ's life was not just to come and tell us the future course of history, but was to come and go in our place to death and judgment so that our sins could be forgiven, so that we could enter into this relationship immediately as we are. We come here tonight and we may be inclined to say, well, I don't know, if God's there, I sure haven't been following him. Besides, I've done some things. I've lived it up, lived a wild life. You know, God knows all that stuff about you. I have cursed God. I have shaken my fist at God. I have defied God in my life. He knows all of that. And yet he's saying, why don't you come and let all of that sin be placed on Christ's cross so that you and I can form a relationship right here, right now. This would be a great night to ask God to begin that relationship in your life. You know, there may be a lot of questions left in your mind. I'm sure there are. I sure were in my mind the night I received Christ. I didn't feel I had all the answers. But I had enough. I had the feeling that this was real, and I had the sense that God was calling me. And that was enough to call out to him. This would be the best thing you could come away from this lecture with, would be your own relationship with Jesus Christ. And that's what I'm inviting you to. Also, come back next week as we move ahead into a couple of the most interesting areas in the end time scenario, the signs of the times. Now, before I take questions tonight, I'm going to give you your chance to help the rest of us here as we serve God. And it's important that we all come together and pool some of our resources so that we can rent this place, so that we can do the work we do with the poor. What John Perkins is going to come and lecture about will fire us all with the desire to serve God and reaching out to disadvantaged people. And thank God that we have a way to do that through Urban Concern Ministries, and that we can pool our resources and do that sort of thing. If you're a guest here, I'm not asking you to give. And I hope you'll just feel real comfortable passing it by, because we don't need your money and you're our guest here. Just enjoy our hospitality tonight. The Summer Apologetics Institute, people are signing up for it. This would be a great time. There's brochures here. Sign up and get your seat. You can either sign up for like just a single class, you can sign up for a week, or you can sign up for the whole 2 weeks and get an extremely low price for this. This is going to be very memorable teaching, and we have many people coming in from out of town. I think it'll be exciting for us to have fellowship with Christians from all different types of backgrounds and kind of show them a good time here and a welcome to our fellowship. If you like, if you're new here tonight, we'd like to give you a free book. And this book will explain why you should consider those truth claims of Christ, and we'll go way beyond what we've discussed here tonight. Go to the welcome booth back here and say, "What about the book?" And they'll give you one of those for free. If you'd like to come up and talk to me, if you'd like to talk to one of our teaching team about a question you have, why, we'll be here afterwards and we're happy to talk. All right, do we have any comments or questions then? Yes. The seven heads were the seven empires, five gone. That was the Egyptian, Assyrian, Babylonian, Media, Persian, and Grecian. Those are the five gone. One that is, which is Rome, and one that's yet to come, the resurgence, Rome II. And so you add those together, you got seven heads. Those are the seven kings. He also calls it, and I did pass over this, he also says these are the seven hills upon which the woman sits. And that is a little bit more cryptic, open to more debate, but most people do know the mythical city of seven hills, which refers to the city of Rome. And that's probably the best explanation for why he says seven hills. I don't know. Yeah. Huh? Is the beast going to be aware that he's aligned with Satan? I don't think we have any information on that. And I'm not going to make it up. I don't know. Yeah. Why don't you stand up so we can hear you a little better? What he's referred to is the movement in Israel to go through the U.S. collecting money to rebuild the temple. It's true. And in fact, there's an institute in Jerusalem that's devoted to this, and they have built quite a few of the pieces of furniture and symbolic implements that go into a future temple based on the Old Testament descriptions. Some of those who just went to Israel here recently were talking about visiting this place and seeing they've put together an ephod that would have fit the Old Testament description of a priestly robe with all these stones on it and stuff. And, you know, they're very serious about it. There's a Hebrew prayer that's prayed often in Orthodox synagogues about until we meet again in the temple. it's something that Orthodox Jews in particular believe will happen and are in fact collecting money toward the future of the new temple. Now, how we get from where we are there to actually having a temple, I have no idea, because there's an Arab mosque sitting there right now where it should be. And whether they'll build it in a different location or whether that mosque is somehow moved out of the way, I really couldn't say. But the Bible does declare that against all odds, that temple will be rebuilt. And frankly, it's no more weird to say that, far less to say that, than to say that Israel would come back together as a nation. If that can happen, the temple can definitely happen. And the Bible says it's going to happen. Yeah. So with your own eyes, you witnessed the changes that are happening when you went back to Ireland. the reading I've done has emphasized how broadly the people in Europe want this unification. It's not something that the governments are doing against the will of the citizenry. It's the broad citizenry that is sick of the fighting, sick of competing, and they really want to come together. Business also wants to come together, and really it's the governments, like especially France and England, and some and one or two Scandinavian countries who are sort of resisting it, but the people are the ones pushing for it. And this is why it will happen. It will, the process will be completed. Okay, we're out of time for this week. So thank you for coming out, and why don't we turn to the Lord in closing. Heavenly Father, you truly are the Lord of history. Whenever you announced yourself in the Old Testament, you would always say, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm the God who brought you up out of Egypt. And you identified yourself as the God of history. And we see how true this is, God, when we look about us and see your prophetic scenario materializing out of thin air right before our eyes. It's really kind of exciting, God, because we know that we can trust you when you speak in spiritual areas, when you tell us how to grow spiritually, when you tell us how to attain eternal life. We can trust all of these statements of yours because we have the clear evidence right before us that your word truly is authoritative and contains deep things that are not known elsewhere. That's a really important thing to us, God. We praise and thank you for it. In Christ's name, amen.